Now we're holding on page Tes Vav in Yevamos, Ois Lamed Hei, Ha'oro Perek Shmini. So the beginning of the Perek continues talking about these dinim of Koyanim and their families eating Truma, and it mentions in that connection an Oral was not allowed to eat Truma, and that leads into a discussion about certain dinim of Bris Milah. Most of the dinim of Bris Milah are found actually in Masechta Shabbos in the 19th Perek, because it talks about Milah and Shabbos, and then it talks about the dinim in general, but you have some of them in this Gemara here in Yevamos. So the Gemara mentions in this connection, Amar Rav Bar Yitzchak, Amar Rav, Loi Nitna Priyas Milah L'Avram Avinu. The part of Milah, which is Priya, was not given to Avram Avinu. We know that you have two basic parts of the Milah. You have the Milah itself, which is cutting off the Orla, the foreskin, and then you have underneath it, you have a membrane which covers the Atara, and that's peeled open, and that's the second stage called Priya. So now, Rav Bar Yitzchak is telling us that second stage was not given to Avram Avinu. So now, Shenema, as the pasuk says, but Esahi Omer Hashem al Yeshua, as we find, only when they entered Eretz Yisrael, Hashem says to Yeshua, Astelecha Chayvus Tzurim Megomer, make for yourself sharp knives, and the pasuk says, Veshuv Moilus Bnei Yisrael Shenis, and then maul the Jewish people again, a second time. So therefore, we're meant to understand that it means that there were many people over there who had already had a Bris Milah years earlier when they left Mitzrayim. Before they left Mitzrayim, all the males were given a Bris Milah. But now we're saying there needs to be a second one, because all those years there's still been that Priya membrane that's left, and now that has to be removed. Ian Yaakov, by the way, points out as a practical matter, usually the moil just tears open that membrane with his fingernails. You don't usually need a knife for it, b'chlal. So why is it, if we're saying over here that they need the knives in order to do Priya, why would they need knives in the first place? And he says he talked to expert moilim, and they pointed out that where you have, here we're talking about adults, by babies, yeah, by an 8-day-old baby, the Priya membrane is thin and you can tear it with your fingernails, but when you're talking about adults over here, then they would need actual knives. Tosfos, first of all, points out a couple of things over here. First of all, we know that Avraham kept the whole Torah before it was given. You know, he kept even 8 of its Tevshelim. So therefore, Avraham would have done Priya on his own. But he wasn't yet commanded to do it, for reasons that we'll talk about in a minute. So, in fact, there are Mephoshim who learn that maybe, you know, you have like this at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha, when it describes Avraham doing the milah on himself and Yishmael and the rest of the household. So it says over there, by Avraham it says, Behimoyle b'saro losoy, and by Yishmael it says, Behimoyle es b'saro losoy. Why the es? So Rashi explains over there, because by Avraham, it wasn't necessary to do a separate Priya, because already Nismayach HaLidei Tashmish, whereas Yishmael is younger, and therefore, and then he hasn't yet done that, and therefore you need Milah and Priya separately. There are actually Mephoshim who learn, based on what Tosfos is saying over here, that maybe in particular we're saying, so Avraham did Priya, as Tosfos is saying over here, and then by Yishmael, he would have had to do a separate Priya, whereas by himself he didn't need to, but either way, he's doing it for everybody. Then Tosfos brings up the point, anyway, since when can a new mitzvah be given through Yoshua? Ein novi rashoi l'chadish dover me'ata. So Tosfos says it was halacha l'moshe Sinai, and just now we have it written down in a pasuk. The Gemara mentions that concept in a few places. There are halachas, for example, that we find in Psukim in the Novi Yechezkel, and again, Yechezkel being a later Novi after Moshe Rabbeinu, he can't come up with new mitzvahs for us, but we can have it. It was part of Torah Shabbat Peh, and then Yechezkel writes it down in a pasuk. So here would be a similar kind of thing. Other Rishonim give other answers, including that maybe Hashem first told Moshe the mitzvah at the end of the 40 years in Arvas Moav, so therefore when they'd done the earlier Milah, and the Gemara is going to talk about it here, that throughout the 40 years in the desert, in general they weren't doing Milah, so now for the first time Hashem is telling Moshe about it, and therefore now when they cross over the Yarden and for the first time they have the opportunity to do a Bris Milah, then this is the first time that they actually have, that they're actually able to fulfill that mitzvah. A different answer is that Hashem told Moshe to begin with that it's only Chal when they come into Eretz Yisrael. So Ion Yaakov and various other Mephoshim over here talk about reasons behind that, why indeed would Hashem have done that and not given the mitzvah of Priya to Avraham. Ion Yaakov discusses a point because otherwise then it would end up that Bnei Yishmael and Bnei Keturah would do it as well. So like this, by it not being given to Avraham, it's given specifically to us, the Jewish people, then it means that they're barred from it. Daniel Hoyodis has an interesting idea, and he says that that you have, there's an aspect of a mitzvah which is it's greater in a way when a person does a mitzvah on his own. On the other hand, there's a mila when the Eibishter gives it. So therefore, so you have both. Actually, you have a mila, I think he says, but it was mitzvahs before Matan Torah versus afterwards. So therefore, you have both. You have one component of it given before the Torah was given, and one afterwards. There are maimorich siddurs, there's in the siddur in Dach and in Derech Mitzvah Secha, where it talks about dalpich siddurs. There's the idea, first of all, the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya that Mila itself represents a klipah gasa, a very coarse klipah that everybody has to remove, and then you have the Priya represents a finer kind of klipah which not everybody is able to remove on their own, and ultimately we have Umol Hashem Alekecha as Levavcha. So therefore, so there's a mimer in the Siddurim Dach where the Alter Rebbe develops the idea the neshamas of Moshe Rabbeinu's times didn't need priya. They were on a higher level. They were neshamas from Moichin, and therefore they didn't need the priya. Whereas now you come to the neshamas of Yeshua's times, they're neshamas from Midas. They're going to have to be fighting against the seven nations of Canaan, which represent the Midas and Klippa, and therefore they need the priya. Then the Tzemach Tzedek and Derech Mitzvah Secha refers to another mimer of the Alter Rebbe where he says almost the opposite. He says that the dirt that came into Eretz Yisrael had a higher gili of the course, and that necessitated priya. And the Tzemach Tzedek explains it's both. They had the dirt on Midbar had higher neshamas, but on the other hand, they also had less of a gili of the course than the neshamas that are coming into Eretz Yisrael. Okay. So the Gemara asks, you're telling me that Yeshua had to make a second mass bris milah over here because nobody had done priya yet. The question is, why? Maybe you should say that the mass bris milah that Yeshua is being told to do is for the people who had not yet had a bris milah at all. So in other words, you're saying that shuv moilas b'nei Yisrael shenis means everybody has to undergo, in effect, a second mila to remove the priya. Maybe not. Maybe it means the second time in history that it's happening that there's this massive bris mila. Dichtiv, as in fact the psukim are saying, ki mulim hoyu kol ama yotzim, everybody who had left Mitzrayim was circumcised, v'chol ama yiloidim b'midbar b'derech, but everybody who was born in the midbar during their travels, but say some Mitzrayim after they left Mitzrayim, loy malu, had not done bris milah. Four reasons that the Gemara is going to explain, soon why they weren't doing bris milah during those years in the desert. So maybe it means then that Hashem is telling Yeshua, everybody who's never yet had a bris milah because they were born in the desert, now make a mass bris milah for them. The answer is, the Gemara says in Cain, my shuv. Then what does the word shuv mean? Which means return. So that means, in other words, return even to the people who have already been gemalot, and you have to do something else with them. El alav l'priya. So it must mean because Yeshua has to do priya, which hadn't been done before. Or my shenis, in which case, what is the, when the pasuk says, shuv moilus b'nei Yisrael shenis, shuv means return, shenis means again. So why that extra word shenis? La'akushi soif mila l'tchilas mila. Because it wants to tell you that there's a hekesh between the end of the mila, namely the priya, and the beginning of the mila, namely the actual mila, the cutting of the orla itself. Ma'tchilas mila ma'akeves, just like the beginning is ma'akev, obviously you don't cut the orla, then you don't have a bris mila. Afsoif mila ma'akev, it's the same way the end, the priya is also ma'akev. Without it, you don't have a valid bris mila. Ditnan, as in fact we learn in a Mishnah, in Shabbos, where it discusses most of the dinim of mila, Elohim sits in a ma'akvinus ha'mila, the following would be shreds of flesh of the orla that prevent the mila from being valid. Basar achoyfe v'chola, that you have if there's flesh left over that covers most of the atara. So there's different explanations among the Rishonim whether the Atara means the ring that you look at the Eber, you have the body, you have the shaft of it, and then you have at the end, you have the triangular portion. Is the Atara that entire triangular portion, or is it the ring that separates one part from the other? Whatever the case, the point is, if you have enough of the Orla left that covers the majority of the height of it, and the Gemara also explains, it can mean either the majority of the circumference of it most of the way around, or it can mean most of the height of it in any one place, then you don't have a valid bris mila. So the point is, you need to remove the entire Orla, and also the Mishnah mentions over there that you need to do a complete priya as well. Mol v'lay parah, kilo lay mol, you do a bris mila. Without priya, then it's not a valid bris mila. So Rashi actually brings two explanations. One explanation is the Gemara is bothered by, once you're saying that the word shuv is telling us about priya, then what are you doing with the word shenis? And the answer is we're using it for this hekesh. Then Rashi says another explanation is that the Gemara is asking about both of them, about Shuv and about Shenis, that it must be that he was saying that it's being used to tell us about Priya, but maybe not. Maybe it only tells us about this din if some of the Orla is left over. And then Tosfos also discusses and brings a Girsa of Rabbeinu Hananel, which is more similar to Rashi's second explanation, that you could argue that maybe, in fact, the Pasuk is only hinting to us about the concept of making sure not to leave any of the Orla left over, and to make sure that, and therefore, that everybody who hasn't had a Mila yet should have it, and not necessarily to tell us about Priya. But in the end, the Gemara is going to explain that, in fact, there were people who didn't have a Mila, and not necessarily, actually, So the Gemara is not necessarily answering that question, actually. There are, in fact, Rishonim who learn that in Lamaskona, the Gemara says that maybe it's not so. Maybe, in fact, they did have the mitzvah Priya before that as well. And then Hashem is just telling Yeshua, everybody who hasn't had a Mila yet at all, make sure to do it. Anyway, when we say Bosar Achoyfas, so Omer Avinavi, Tamer of Yumi, Ba'aba, Omer Rab, Bosar Achoyfas, really Goyv HaShal HaTorah. It means if there's flesh left over that covers the majority of the height of the HaTorah in any one place, then that's enough to prevent it from being a valid Mila. So not just, in other words, you would think otherwise it means most of the circumference, so now you're being told that it means most of the way around it, now you're being told. Now Ravino, Rav Yumi Abba Abba, is telling us that actually it means even if in one particular spot you have most of the height of the Atorah is covered, and then again you have a Machlokes Rishonim, what Atorah means in this connection, whether it means the entire tip or whether it just means the ring of flesh over there. Alright. So, the Gemara asks, Ramidba my time alay mohol. Well, you're telling me that throughout all the years in the desert they hadn't done Bris Mila, and therefore Hashem has to tell Yeshua now is time to do it. And by the way, Rashi mentions on the Psukim, based on the Drashim, that Yeshua informs them, you're not going to be able to inherit Eretz Yisrael unless you do this. By the way, we find that if we calculate when this took place, they crossed the Yarden on Yud Nisan. They had to have everything done in time to be able to bring the Korban Pesach. And it took time, as the Psukim say, it took a few days for them to recover. It comes out, Chap Zechois, that this mass Bris Mila was done on Yud Aleph Nissen and the subsequent days. So Ramidba my time alay mohol. So why all those years in the desert were they in fact not doing Bris Mila? So one possibility is Mishum Chulsha De'urcha, because of the weakness and the tiredness of travel. They're constantly on the move, they never know. You might even have, like it describes in Parshas Ba'aloscha, they might come to a certain place and the Onan rests over there and they start unpacking and setting everything up, and then the next morning the Onan moves and they have to be on the move again. So they never know how long they're going to be in any one place. And since we know a couple of days after Bris Mila is hazardous, we find by Shem, for example, so they were concerned about the potential danger, and they can't do Bris Mila. The Ibori Sema, another explanation, Mishum Dolei Noshiv Lahu Ruach Tzfonis. The reason is because all those years that they were in the desert, the north wind did not blow. And the north wind, the Gemara explains, it's a calm wind. It helps clear the clouds and make the sun. So therefore you have the sunshine and its full effect, and that's a healing thing. We know the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra that there's the famous precious stone that was hanging around Avraham's neck, which the Eved put on the sun, and therefore you see that when it's during the daytime, sick people usually feel better. So here also the idea is the rays of the sun would heal the Bris Mila faster, but meanwhile, now we're saying, though, the north wind did not blow, so therefore they didn't have a clear sky, and therefore they were afraid to do Bris Mila. Tosfos actually points out that in this regard, we don't mean that there was never a north wind at all. The Gemara, in fact, elsewhere says there has to be a north wind every day, because the north wind is a cooling wind. Otherwise, you'd have too much global warming, basically, and then people wouldn't be able to survive. So it just means that there was no north wind by itself, as opposed to the rest of the time when there was. By the way, it's mentioned that Shevet Levi didn't worry about any of this, and they continued to do Bris Milah during all those years. So when Moshe Rabbeinu tells them, and when Moshe Rabbeinu praises them in Vezoyis HaBracha, and he says, Ki Shomru Umasechol Bris Chayin Soru, Rashi mentions over there it means that throughout all those years in the desert, they were maling their own children, and now they're available to mal everybody else when Yeshua tells them to, because they kept up the mitzvah, and they didn't worry about these dangers that we're talking about. Marsha points out that actually you really have both of these points are hinted at in the Pesukim in Yeshua. The first pasuk actually, the first reason because of the strains of the journey that it says explicitly in the pasuk. Ki arelem hoyu ki lemolu oisem badorech. They couldn't mal them on the way because of all the strains and stresses of traveling. As far as the Ruach Tzfonis is, the Pasuk says afterwards, after they had finished this mass Bris Milah, the Pasuk says, Vayeshu sachtam b'machna ad chayosam. They stayed in the machna until they recovered. So in other words, that's the point. Now they're able to stay in one place, and the Ruach Tzfonis will blow, and as the Gemara is going to say, the reason there was no Ruach Tzfonis is because it would scatter the Anani HaKavod. Now that they're in Gilgal, and Eretz Yisrael, they don't have the Anani HaKavod anymore. Therefore, their north wind can blow, and it can be a healing, and it can be a healing thing. But up until that point, they couldn't. So why didn't they have Ruach Tzfonis? My time, and in turn, we have to ask, why was there no Ruach Tzfonis? One reason is because they were in a state of disgrace by Hashem. They had done the Cheta Ego, Rashi says, or Tosfa says it was because of the Cheta Meraglim, and therefore they don't deserve to have the brilliant, unobstructed light of the sun. And the Ruach Tzfonis, Tosfos points out, it's not so much that the Ruach Tzfonis itself is a healing wind, it's that it clears away the clouds and therefore makes it that, and now you have the full brightness and the full intensity of the sun, and that helps heal. So now they were Nizufim, so therefore they don't deserve to have that unobstructed sunlight, and therefore, without that, then they didn't feel that it was safe to do Bris Milah. So again, Rashi says because of the chet ego. Tosfos says, wait a minute though, we find that Hashem forgave them for it, and Hashem gave them the Mishkan afterwards. No, it means the chet meraglim. So that's one reason. The other reason is so that the Anani HaKavod aren't dispersed. Again, since the north wind scatters clouds, so it would end up scattering the Anani HaKavod. So therefore, to prevent that, then the Eved made that there's no north wind. And there's a point that's made in Etim, and what, the Eved is not Kol Yochol, he can make a north wind, and it wouldn't scatter the Anani HaKavod. So there's a point that's made, actually, that the intensity of the Anani HaKavod depended on the Maisim of the Jewish people, and since at this point they're not worthy of having the full intensity of the Anani HaKavod as they did before, so therefore north wind would be able to scatter them, and therefore the Eved isn't bringing that wind. Now, Tosfos mentions in this connection that actually you have the Sifri mentions when we have about the Pesach that they made the second year in the Midbar, the one where the people came and complained, Lama Nigora, and Moshe told them the mitzvah Pesach Sheni. The Sifri says this is Begnus, actually brings it on the Pasuk, Begnus and Sho Yisrael, Dibra Kosov. This is a derogatory thing about the Jewish people, but look at this, all those 40 years in the desert, they only made the one Pesach. So Tosfos points out over here, when you think about it, then they couldn't anyway, because the fact is, we're saying they couldn't do Bris Milah, they couldn't or wouldn't do Bris Milah, and the din is when you have an oral in your family and you can't make a Korban Pesach. So Tosfos says, actually, maybe that's what it means. It means they did bring Korbanos Pesach some of the other years, but that was the only year when they did it the way it's supposed to be, with everybody having been gemal. After that, because they were afraid to do it for the reasons that the Gemara is saying over here, so even if they did make Korbanos Pesach in future years, it wasn't really the right way to do it because they had people in their families who were Arelin. Tosfos also deals with the question also, by the way, if they were Arelim, how would they be able to eat Korbanos all those years? And one point is, Haka, if they're not able to eat Korbanos because they're Arelim, then they would have a heter from Sar Taiva. They would have a heter, like this usually we learned, that during the 40 years in the desert, if they were going to shecht an animal, it had to be brought as a korban. They couldn't shecht and eat chulin in the desert. But then the question is, how did anybody who was not gemalik eat if they couldn't eat korbanos? And the answer is, okay, well, if they can't eat because they're arelim, then yeah, they'd be able to have the sar taiva. Mind you, there is anyway an opinion of Rabbi Akiva, I think, in the Gemara in Chulin, that the Rambam brings it lahalacha, that actually in the Midbar they didn't even have to shecht animals to eat them anyway. They could kill them any way they wanted, and that would be valid, and they could eat, and they could eat the meat that way. Only after they come into Eretz Yisrael do we have the concept that you have to shecht, and that's the only valid way to eat meat. All right, so since we're saying that the north wind clears away the clouds and is healthy, and that's a time when it's better to do bris milah and other kinds of surgeries, so the Gemara says, Amar Papa Hilkoch, based on that, you can see Yoyma de Iva on a day when on a cloudy day, the Yoyma de Shusa, and on a day when the south wind blows, where the Gemara mentions in many places that the south wind is a very strong, harsh wind, Loyma Halinen Bay Veloyma Sikrinan Bay. On such a day, you should not do a bris milah, and you should also not do bloodletting. Because the point is that then you don't have the good effect of the sun. Because you have the clouds, or you have the strong wind, and therefore it might be dangerous to the baby or to the person who's having bloodletting done. Marshall mentions over here that there's a pasuk actually that speaks of Shemesh Tzedakah u'Marfei d'Knafeha, a sun of healing, a sun of Tzedakah with healing in its wings. So we see, in other words, that the sun is very good for sick people.
How is it possible not to make a brace because of the wind?
So the Gemara says, "V'ha'idna the doshu be'rabim." However, nowadays that people are accustomed to do that, people don't look at the weather when they're making a brace or when they do bloodletting. So then we have the rule: Shema p'soyim Hashem. Hashem watches over the simple meaning. In other words, when you have something which is commonly done and most people don't suffer any ill effects from it, then you don't have to worry about the myriad of times that it might. This principle is comes up in halacha in many, many places. There's all kinds of things that we do nowadays. You think about it, for example, traveling in a car potentially could be dangerous. Rachman Latzlan, you hear of car accidents all the time. You have all kinds of things like that. When you have something that the rule is, when you have something that's commonly done and most people come through it without any problems, then you're allowed to do it, and you're allowed to trust in the Eidishter that you'll be fine as well. And you don't have to worry about the mute where something goes wrong. And there's a lot of detail about it in Poskim Achronim. Rav Moshe, for example, talks about it in a bunch of his Trubas in different places. Different other Achronim also talk about, you have, for example, when it's something that's known already not to be healthy, smoking being one example, then already you don't have that heter of Shem Epsoyim Hashem, and you have a variety of other details that go into it. But there is that basic concept. With that said, I think it is where the poskim do say, if a person taka wants to push off a bris milah because of this gemara, because it's a cloudy day, then you're not gonna force him to do it against what the gemara is saying over here. But nevertheless, it's and most people are not gonna pay attention to that. All right, the gemara continues. Tana Rabbanan, kol oisam arboim shana shahoy Yisrael b'midbar, throughout all those 40 years that the Jewish people were in the desert. There was not a single day when the north wind did not blow in the middle of the night. In general, Rashi brings that Tosfos had brought, first of all, there had to be a north wind every day, because otherwise, Eina Olam Miskayim. But as the Gemara is going to explain over here, the midnight is particularly a time when the north wind blows. We find that in the middle of the night, by Chatzos HaLaila, is when Makas Mechoros took place. So my Talmuda. So what does that tell us? The fact that Makas Mechoros took place at Chatzos, what does that have to do with anything? What it's coming to tell you, the Ace Rotzen Milsim. An Ace Rotzen, a time when Hashem is favorable to us, is a significant time, and you should take advantage of it. Meaning, in other words, Chatzos is an Ace Rotzen. We see that the Eibishter brought Makas Mechoros on it. And in fact, one point is that demonstrates that it was an Ace Rotzen in the sense, after all, you have, as the Malachi Asharis argued a few days later, by Kriyas Yamsef, Manishtanu Elam Elu, why do the Jewish people deserve to be spared, and the Mitzrayim punished? But we see that the Eibishter overrode that, and then it was an Ace Rotzen, and Makas Mechoros took place then. So therefore, it's also an Eitz Rotzen for the Ruach Tzfonis, where again, the Ruach Tzfonis being a gentle wind that helps cool down the world and helps make things more comfortable. So therefore, so that takes place Dafka by Chatzos HaLaila. Rashi, in fact, points out, we find famously that David HaMelech took advantage of that. He had his harp suspended over his bed. And every night, and every night by Chatzos, the north wind would say, had the position just that the north wind would hit the strings, and it would start strumming, and then it would wake him up to start learning Torah. So the point is, therefore, that Chatzos Halayla is an ace rotzen. That's why we have the whole concept of Tikkun Chatzos, for example. Marsha says another way of understanding what the Gemara is saying is, we see, usually the north wind is a healing wind, as we're saying over here. On the other hand, by Machas Bechoras, the Eivishta did exactly the opposite. That was the very moment when all the Bechorim and Mitzrayim dropped dead. So therefore, so you see that the Eivishta changes Teva, that even though you have, normally it's an Eitz Ratzin, here it was the opposite of an Eitz Ratzin for the Mitzrayim, but we see that it is an Eitz, we see that it is an Eitz Ratzin, and that means it sets a time to take advantage of in terms of Tikkun Chatzos, for example.
It's an Eitz Ratzin for the Eid.
It's an Eitz Ratzin for us Jewish people, right, right. So you have Yichidus Segula nowadays that do Tikkun Chatzos. It's interesting, actually, because the Alter Rebbe talks about Negeres HaTshuva and in the Siddur that people in general should be doing Tikkun Chatzos. I think in Tanya, the Alter Rebbe says at least the person should be doing it once a week, Akaponim, but here we see that nowadays it seems to be only the Yichidus Segula who do it. What? Say what? That's a very good question. I don't know. In fact, a good question.
Do it one time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Really,
yeah, it seems to be a very rare thing. It seems to be a very rare thing nowadays. I don't know why.
No,
I mean, I guess one practical thing really might be that our sleep patterns are a lot different than they were back then. Back then, generally, people went to sleep not long after it got dark. And therefore, so you'd sleep a few hours and then you'd wake up by Chatzos, and then if you're going to sleep again for a few hours in the early morning after Tikkun Chatzos, then maybe you'd do that, and if not, you'd stay up learning. Mashenkin nowadays, we don't go to bed until 10 or 11 at night. So, I don't know, maybe that factors into it, I don't know.
Somebody in Israel, Rob, somebody his name, gave all explanation that you really have to know what you're doing with Tikkun Chatzos. Since
you don't know what you're doing, then therefore you should. Depends on.
No, it doesn't say not to wake up. Wake up, but learn
Chassidus. But learn Chassidus, I hear. Okay, depends on. I'd be interested who this Rav is, but okay, I hear. Incidentally, the Alter Rebbe mentions in that connection, so here we're saying it's an Eis Rotzen, but you know, in every time zone, Chatzos HaLaila is a different time. So the Alter Rebbe famously mentions in Madura Basra of Shulchan Aruch that in every individual place, the Eis Rotzen is in the local Chatzos. Not everybody agrees with that, by the way. There are Achronim, I think, for example, Rabbi Yonis and Ivershitz disagrees with that concept and says, no, it would be the Eis Rotzen is when it's Chatzos HaLaila in Eretz Yisrael. So for us in New York, then it would come out for 5 o'clock in the afternoon or something. But not, I don't know if he's necessarily saying that's when you'd grab a Tikkun Chatzos if you live in New York. But Akaponim is saying that there's only one Eis Rotzen and it goes according to the time zone of Eretz Yisrael. Whereas the Alter Rebbe says, since Lamaila is higher than Zman anyway, it comes down in each individual place according to the local Zmanim. And therefore, in every individual place, you have the local Chatzos HaLaila.
Like the sixth hour when it comes to
Kiddush. The Alter Rebbe compares it also to the fact that you see Shabbos and Yom Tov begin in every time zone according to its place. And every Shachos and Chamayrav too, yeah. Okay. I mean, this is Negeil Halacha as well. The Alter Rebbe in that connection mentions also that because of that is therefore, so if you're in Chutzlar, that you keep 2 days Yom Tov, even if you're Ben Eretz Yisrael. And if you're in Eretz Yisrael, you keep 1 day, even if you're Ben Chutzlar. There is a considerable amount of discussion about that because the Velt holds, and the Alter Rebbe himself writes in Madur Kama of Shulchan Aruch, that no, it depends whether you're only visiting, whether Daite Lachzer, et cetera, and therefore, you see by the Velt, many people, yeah, many Bnei Eretz Yisrael will visit Chutz La'aretz and they keep only 1 day, and many Bnei Chutz La'aretz will visit Eretz Yisrael and keep 2 days. Whereas by us, even within Lubavitch itself, I understand there are different opinions among Lubavitch and Rabbanim whether to follow that Madura Basra of the Alter Rebbe LaHalacha or whether the Alter Rebbe is only saying it as kind of like an incidental thing. Maybe we go according to what he writes more clearly in Hilchos Yom Tov, which is that it depends whether Daiter Lachzer and so forth.
I asked Rabbi, he told me that if you are with your family, then you are a Ben Amofen. If you are by yourself, then you do what...
Then you do what the low, then you do what you come from. Interesting. Okay. I guess that's hard. Okay. So, yeah.
People are coming here from Tishrei. Doesn't matter the tamid is selling or not. Everyone making.
So that's what I'm saying. You have different Lubavitcher Rabbanim themselves who argue on this point. And like I say, in the Welt, I think more usually they do hold like the shitta that says you go according to where you came from, and as long as daita lachser. But there are different poskim who talk about different possibilities within that. The Alter Rebbe is not a das. The Alter Rebbe and Madura Basra is not a das yochid on that. I believe Rabbi Yaakov Emdin, among others, holds the same way as well. So there are in the Welt you can find people who.
Right.
So that's what Menachem was saying, that Rabbi Farkash said like that. A bacher, as the pashtos is, according to that psach, would not. He would go according to where he comes from, because he's not staying permanently. All right, fine. No, well, again, I mean, I'm not saying when Rabbi Yonis and Eibeshitz, for example, says that Eis Rotzen goes according to the time of Eretz Yisrael, he's not necessarily saying that if you live in New York, you should do Tikkun Chatzos at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But Pashas, he means there is a certain time of day, which is an Eis Rotzen, and it goes according to the time zone of Eretz Yisrael.
The
Moilad, actually, so we have the Moilad that we announce is according to Eretz Yisrael time. When you're figuring out Sosman Kiddush Levana, then you do, in fact, have to adjust it for local time. Onward. Further on in the Perek, it talks about, now we know there's a number of people who the Torah tells us they're not allowed to intermarry into Kahal Hashem, where there's Psur Dako, Kruz Shofcha, which are discussed earlier in the Perek, and then you have the various ones. You have Gerim from Mitzrayim and Edom, and you have men from Ammon and Moab. So the Gemara discusses the point of, so the Gemara, just, the Gemara brings up the point about now we know Shloima married Bas Parei. So in the Gemara, before we get to the part over here in Ein Yaakov, then the Gemara brings that Rava had said the Torah never used the Pesukim, never used the word Chitun, the word that there was a chasana between a Yid and a Goy. If it says Vayischaten, then it means we're talking about two Jews. It means we're talking about that they were Megayer. So the Gemara says Masiv Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef says, then I have a contradiction to that. The Pasuk says, Vayischaten Shloima es Parei Melech Mitzrayim, that Shloima married the daughter of Parei. And at this point, the Gemara is assuming that he wasn't Megayer her. It doesn't say in the Pesukim that he was Megayer her after all. So that would mean that the word Vayischaten can be used about a relationship between a Jew and a Goy. The answer is no, Goyure Gaira. He was in fact Megayer her. The Rambam, in fact, makes the point very forcefully in Hilchos Yisurei Bia, that how could he possibly think that Shlomo, who's called Yedid Hashem, that he would marry a Goita? So the question is, how could he be Megayer? V'holei kiblu gerim loy b'mei David v'loy b'mei Shlomo. We know, we talked about earlier in the Masechta, that they didn't accept gerim in the times of David and Shlomo, because there's too much of a likelihood that a person is becoming a ger, because they want to join in and the riches and the power of the Jewish people. So how could they accept her as a geiris? So the Gemara answers, Midi hu taima elul shulchan malachim. Listen, the whole reason you're not allowed to accept gerim in that time is because we're concerned that they want shulchan malachim, they want the king's tables. Well, Bas Parei didn't need it. She's a princess herself. She anyway is born into riches and power and all that. So if she's becoming a geiris, we can say that she's doing it l'shem shemayim, and therefore that Shlomo would be allowed to have her become a geiris. Tosfos actually points out there are a couple of ways of understanding the question of the Gemara. One question is, one way of understanding the question, you know what, actually, I see, I skipped a few lines. Wait, how did I, yeah, I skipped a few lines at the end of the previous, sorry about that. Let's go back. Omen of Huna, Dvar Torah Moshuch Oichel B'Tshuva, Minat Torah. Now, so we're talking about an oral over here. We're talking about a person who has never had a bris milah at all. Now, you also have something called Moshuch, which is where the skin has been stretched out and he looks like an oral. It could happen because of illness, that is, his flesh becomes, his skin becomes, starts drooping, or it could be because it was done artificially to make him look like he wasn't gemalot. Historically, there were a number of times, the Gemara is going to bring over here from the times of Ben Kuziva, it's brought also, the books of Chashminoyim describe how in the early years after the Mesiavnim were starting to gain power in Eretz Yisrael, in the decades before the story of Hanukkah, that also they opened a gymnasium in Yerushalayim, and in Greek gymnasia they'd play those sports and whatnot naked, so Jews who went to these places would be embarrassed of their milah, but while the Greeks and the Romans we considered bris milah to be a blemish, and they used to mock Jews for having it. So there would be Jews who would attend these things who would deliberately go and try to conceal their milah. So such a person is called a moshuch, that the skin has been stretched out. So Amar Rav Huna, Dvar Torah moshuch oichel b'truma. Mina Torah, even though we're saying the Gemara had established, the Mishnah and the Gemara had established that an oral is also to eat truma, but a moshuch would be allowed to midaraisa, because the fact is he has had a bris milah. Umidivrehem goes through all of it. It's only midrabanan that they made a rule that he should not, if nation nira ka oral, because he looks like an oral, because after all, it looks, for whatever reason, that the skin is stretched out, it looks like he's an oral. So the Havi of the Gemara alzas, and then the Gemara in turn brings there, in the course of the discussion, that Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a moshuch lo yimum, if nation sakana hiloi. Rabbi Yehuda says, b'chlal, a moshuch should not do a second bris milah. On the face of it, you have the skin is covering the atara. Shouldn't he do a bris milah? Rabbi Yehuda says, don't. Mefesh sakana, he loy, it's a sakana. He might cut wrongly, and then there he goes. He becomes a kurus shracha. Omru loy, but the chachamim told Rabbi Yehuda, v'aloi harim molu b'mei ben kuziva. Don't we see though, that there were a lot of people who mauled in the time of ben kuziva? Ben Kuziva is better known in history as Bar Kochva. We know famously that Rama mentions that Rabbi Akiva was Nosa Kalim, and he thought that he was Mashiach, and so on and so forth. So during that time, also, this was a period when the Goyim, when the Romans had made a Xera against Bris Milah, because again, B'chlal, the Romans considered Bris Milah to weak, and we say that, we say, as the Mishnah says, Mu'usehi Orla, that an Orla is a disgusting, repulsive thing. They, Lahavdol, took the opposite view. They said bris milah is something shameful and whatever. So they would often make xeris against it. So here you have an Adrianus, Caesar, Hadrian, made a xera against it. And the result was there were many people who were forced by the Goyim to become meshuchim. So many people did that. Rashi says, in particular, in the city of Beitar. Eventually, Ben Kuziva, Bar Kochla, overpowered them, and he fought against them and beat them and ruled over the Jewish people for a couple of years. They've actually found coins of him, for example, showing that he actually gained independence for a period of time. So now these people, after it's safe, after Ben Kuziva took over and there's a Jewish government again, so they did a second milah to remove that stretched out skin. And they eventually had children. So therefore, they say to Rabbi Yehuda, you see, there's no danger involved in a moshuch doing a second bris milah. So now getting to the next point. So again, you have this business about where the Gemara says that if you have a relationship between a Jew and a goy, it's not called in the Torah chitun. Which means, in other words, therefore, the point is, when the Torah says, lois tischatin bom, you're not allowed to intermarry with the seven nations of Canaan, it would mean even after they become gerim. Because you can't say it means while they're goyim, because while they're goyim, you can't call it like tischatin in the first place, says Rava. There is, by the way, a bit of discussion about that. Tosfos elsewhere talks about, for example, in that case, how did Yeshua marry Rachel? She was a Gioris from the seven nations. And Tosfos gives a couple of answers, one of them being that this rule applied only... No. The two different things. First, the Gemara is saying that when the Torah says about the seven nations of Canaan, lois tischat en bom, you're not allowed to intermarry with them, that it means even after the Nisgayer. Never mind David and Shlomo's times. Throughout a person from the seven nations in the Nisgayer, the Pasuk is saying you're not allowed to intermarry with them. So now, Tosfos elsewhere discusses in that case, and how, for example, could Yeshua marry Rachel? And there's a couple of answers, one of them being that it was before the Jewish people had conquered Eretz Yisrael, and therefore that's different. The rule of lois tischat en bom would mean once they came and conquered Eretz Yisrael. Another answer, Tosfos says it was al-pi ad-dibur, there was a special nevuah that in this case he should. Anyway, so now the Gemara says, Mosif Rabbi Yosef. So Rabbi Yosef says, you're telling me that it never says the word chitun between a Jew and a goy, but what about Yischat and Shlomo es Pare Melech Mitzrayim? Again, where it's mashma that he wasn't Megayer her. He wasn't, no, Gayuri Gaira. He was Megayer her. And in fact, the Rambam makes the point and says it has to be, how could you say that Shlomo, Yedid Hashem, would marry a goyte? So again, the question is, while they kibbutz gerim loy b'mei David v'loy b'mei Shlomo, they didn't accept gerim in those times because we're concerned that they're doing it only to join in the wealth and power of the Jewish people. The Gemara answers, midi hu taima elo l'shochan malachim. Look, the whole reason is because we're afraid they only want the table of the kings. They want the riches and the power. Paulei tzricha loy, she doesn't need it. She's already a princess anyhow. So I was starting to say that there's a couple of different ways of understanding the question of the Gemara. Is the question that... And is the question to begin with, well, how, so how could he be Megayer? Or is the question more like, so in other words, one way of understanding the question is that, how could he marry her? Mela, in other words, you're going to say that they just had a relationship of Znus. Then, at this point in history, there wasn't yet a Gzera against a Jew and a Goita having relations. You do have Kanoim Poygam by Zumi and Kozvi, but that's only Tosfos Yishonim points out, that's only when it's Befa Hesya. Here it would be more Betzina. So then, and later on, the Gemara tells us, in Avodah Zarah, the Beis Din Shel Hashmonaim, a few hundred years later, made a gzeira against Jews having relationships outside of marriage with goites. But you wouldn't have that yet over here. But the question would be, if you're telling her he was Megayer, if you're telling me that he was Megayer, her, then how could he do that if they didn't accept Gerim, and if they didn't accept Gerim in those times? So that's one way of understanding the question. So the question is, well, mitzvus yushoinehi v'chorah. Then the Gemara asks, but don't we have, the Torah says, you're not allowed to intermarry with a mitzvah first generation ger. And she's a giyotis from Mitzrayim, she's first generation, because she was a goita before, so Shlomo wouldn't be allowed to marry her anyway. Now, the Mishnah does mention that Reb Shimon says they are, that the women are allowed to. Reb Shimon makes basically a kal v'chomer. He says the same way as by Ammon and Moav, Ammoni v'loy Ammonis, Moav v'loy Moavis. He says the same thing applies to Mitzrayim and Edom. The Chachamim disagree with him. So you could answer that Shlomo followed Reb Shimon's opinion, but the Gemara would rather find that what he's doing is valid even according to the Chachamim. So Amar Papa, Anan mi Shlomo leiku v'nesiv. You're thinking that we should come and ask a question from Shlomo? He said, no, Shlomo le nosid midi. He never married her in the first place. He just had a relationship with her outside of marriage. Dichtiv dei, as in fact the pasuk says, minagoyim asher omer Hashem al bnei Yisrael, that he married women from the various nations that Hashem said, lo yisavoyu b'hem v'hem lo yavoyu b'hem, don't intermarry with them and they shouldn't intermarry with you. Ochen yato es levavchem achre elekehem, because then they're going to end up swaying your heart after their getches. B'hem dovak Shlomo la'ahava. And yet Shlomo connected with these women and loved them. So the expression la'ahava implies that he didn't actually marry them, he was doing znus with them. Which again, during the time before the Beis Din Shel Hashmonaim came along, it would have been technically mutter. So Shlomo is doing that basically according to the Rav Papa is saying to get around the issur of marrying. What?
Sheba?
The Queen of Sheba is something else. The pasuk doesn't say that they had relations. There's a note inserted into Rashi that comes from a later sefer that comes, I think, from the Arizal that says that he had relations with her and eventually Nebuchadnezzar descended from them. But the pasuk doesn't say any such thing. But the pasuk openly says that he had these various wives from Mitzrayim and Moav and Ammon and Edom and so on and so forth. So now Rav Papa is saying you should know the ones that are oster tame, at least he didn't actually marry. He's just having relations with them outside of marriage. So therefore, so one way of explaining it then could be that he is Megayer them, and fine, the Torah is only asking after they're Niskayer to marry them, but not to have relations with them outside of marriage. At worst, it would be an Isser Lav. Or the other way of saying is that maybe the Gemara is saying, in that case, it's not necessary to say that he was Megayer them in the first place, because again, before the Beis Din Shel Hashmonaim, such a thing would technically be Mutter, at least Betzina.
Who did Yosef marry?
Who did Yosef marry? Osnas, but that was before the Torah was given. That's different. Osnas, so anyway, wasn't a mitzvah, right? According to the Medrash, anyway, she's the daughter of Shimon and Dinah, yeah.
And there's
the Shvatim are all married. The Shvatim are all married. Knanias, yeah. According to one opinion, anyway, yeah. Okay, so Ela Kasha Vaischatin, fine. What are you doing though? But the fact is, the Pasuk says about Bas Pari that he married her. So the answer would be Mitoch Ava Yisera Sha'ava, because he loved her so much. Mala all of our costs of killing his chatinba. So the pasuk talks about it as though he married her, but in fact he did not, because again we have two different ways of understanding the whole flow of the Gemara over here. Whether in the end we're saying he was Megayer her, but he had a relationship with her outside of marriage to avoid the issue of a mitzvah, or that b'chalal he wasn't Megayer her in the first place, and that during that period such a thing would have been technically mutter.
But
Shlomo married Nama. So Nama Hamonis is something else. That's Nama Hamonis, fine. Ammoni v'lay Ammonis. There's no problem with that lahalacha. There can be a problem in that Nama herself was not necessarily Sittu Tzadekas. That's a different matter. Some of the Mephoshim say that she was an outright Rashas. That's a different problem. But at least as far as the technicalities, with an Ammonis, there's no issue. But with a Mitzvah, there is, because she's the first generation Mitzvah. There is very little. Some of the Mefoshim, though, point out, because you have, it mentions Nama a couple of times in connection with Rechavam, and Rechavam ended up worshipping Avodah Zarah and doing other Averis, so therefore, so there were Mefoshim who learned that's because he, Nama, his mother, had a bad effect on him. But on the other hand, maybe, on the other hand, it's...
Yeah, I don't know what either of these is. That can Nama, she was
Nama. So there is actually, yeah, there's something from, there's something that the Ramami Fano brings in his Sefer Asorah Amoris. He brings a Medrash that tells the whole story of how Nama saved Shlomo HaMelech, and with that saved the whole Malchus Beis David. You think of it also, you know, the Gemara, when the Gemara mentions...
It wasn't
a person has Bechira Chofshis after all. But, you know, you consider also the fact that the Gemara says in a few places that the Ebesh just says, Shnei Pridis Tovis Yeshli Lahotzi, that I have two precious doves that I want to bring out from Ammon and Moab, and you have Rus and Nama, and Rus, we know, was a Tzadikus. It shows that maybe Nama was not so, was at least not so bad either. But you know, the fact is, there are Mephoshim who say that she was, yeah. Anyway. Fine. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGo'ola. The Medrash says about Tchias HaMesim, the way a person goes is the way he's going to come. So if he goes after 120 blind, he's going to come back blind. If he comes back, and later on it says that the Ebeshter then will heal everybody's mumim. And if he goes dressed, then he comes back dressed as well. Now that also applies, the Rebbe points out, that also applies. So first of all, what does that mean as far as the person's levushim? So there's two possible meanings. It can mean the clothing that he was buried with, the tachrichim, or it can mean the regular clothing that he wore during his lifetime. So what it means, one of those two, he'll come back at by Tzeis HaMesim with one of those, with one of those types of clothing. Okay, continuing with halachas of muktzah. You have a concept called noilad, something that was newly created today and didn't exist in this form before. One example would be, for example, ashes from a fire. Another example would be an egg that was laid today. There are several other things that were things that come from a maisa, which is also to do today, for example, fruit that fell off a tree. So all those kinds of things are also muktzah. So on Yom Tov, you have more of a concept of Noilad. You have, for example, a Beit Shenolda on one day on Yom Tov is also on the following Shabbos as well, but here we have, to a certain extent, it is also on Shabbos as well. Also the Tiltel, that is.